From the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is The Beloved Community. I'm John Schock. On The Beloved Community, you hear resources for activism.
The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community. The aftermath of nonviolence is redemption. The aftermath of nonviolence is reconciliation. The aftermath of violence, however, is bitterness. This is the thing I'm concerned about. Let us fight passionately and unrelentingly for the goals of justice and freedom. Let's be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle.
I'm John Schock. My guest is Paul Rowland. Paul is an environmental activist and a Native American activist, and he's also the host of Wednesday Talk Radio on KBOO. That's Wednesday mornings from 8 to 9 every week on 90.7 KBOO. He's with me today to talk about a religious movement that began way back in the 12th century, ruled a heresy by the Catholic Church, but it still has its adherents today, the Waldensians. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, John.
You talked to me just casually about a show about the Waldensians, and I hadn't remembered them since I went to seminary. So I kind of was a little rusty about it, but you have a personal connection. Tell me about the Waldensians.
Well, you know, they say, and I think it might be accurate, that they're the only medieval heresy that actually survived and became like an official institutional church in the modern world. Keeping the original name. So I'm not, you know, I don't consider myself a Waldensian. It's very kind of a complex thing, but my father was from a prominent Waldensian family from what they call the Waldensian Valleys of northwestern Italy, pretty much where they had holed up in, they were also on the French side, but there's some massacres that pretty much eliminated their presence there. And we're talking centuries ago. But they ended up surviving in these three small valleys in the Caudian Northwest Alps, just west of Turin, the big industrial city. And as I said, they survived over for, 600-700 years there. And through massacres, through repression, through this, that, and the other thing. And yeah, my family were Waldensians. I mean, my dad basically left the church. I don't know how religious even his family was. I was thinking about that actually last night as I was going to sleep, thinking about this interview. I don't think his dad was that religious. I don't know. I don't even know. I didn't even talk to him about it. I don't even know if they were church. If they went to church, but I do know that it was a big thing in their life. In those valleys, it's like they called it, it has many nicknames. They called it the Israel of the Alps.
Israel of the Alps.
Yeah, because it survived as a pre-Protestant, and then they joined the Protestant Reformation, you know, when it came along. But they survived as first a heresy and then a Protestant ultra minority in a very Catholic country for, you know, hundreds of years against all odds.
Yeah, they really predated the Protestant Reformation. I mean, many of the things that they believed in later came out with Luther and Calvin, not only theological, but also political, opposing sending basic money to Rome, those kinds of things, an emphasis on voluntary poverty and social justice issues that they still carry on today.
And certain theological things too. You know, they didn't believe in the Pope's infallibility.
Right.
In fact, they went against that. That's what got him into a lot of trouble from the very beginning, from Peter Waldo, who's, you know, then there's some, he's the ostensible founder of Waldensianism. Yeah. He was a merchant, apparently a wealthy merchant in Lyon, France, in northeastern France, and ended up having a series of things happen apparently to him that led him to some kind of spiritual crisis, and he gave away a bunch of his property to his wife. I'm not sure how that works. And then the rest of it he gave away to the poor, and went around preaching rustic clothing. They became his followers. He ended up preaching in the streets of Lyon and attracting followers, like so many, as you said earlier before we started taping, that you studied seminary and studied some of these heretical movements. There are so many heretical movements because, you know, feudalism was imposing itself on this variegated, you know, cultural landscape. And so, and it was being, you know, areas were being Christianized that hadn't been Christian. So you had, you know, you had syncretic kind of movements, you know, you had areas on the far margins and probably in the mountains that were, you know, probably had residual cultural, you know, cultural resistance to hegemony, whether, you know, whether feudal hegemony, whether Catholic hegemony. So, yeah, so you had all these cultural resistance movements of various kinds, and they, you know, ended up taking the form of Christianity, you know, and, you know, resistance from within Christianity because, you know, areas were forcibly Christianized. And so, you know, it's, so who knows what, you know, I'm really interested as someone who's like not Christian, but has this intense connection to it, you know, to what extent were there like, were there sort of residual, you know, not even non-Christian elements to it, you know. But anyway, so yeah, so it goes back to Lyon, goes back to Peter Waldo. He ended up being called to Rome to account for the fact that he was preaching and you couldn't preach unless you were an official priest.
Right.
That was a big, big thing. And it remains a major tenet. Lay, you know, the congregation, they are all basically considered preachers. Any person can preach, you know. And in fact, they develop schools. In the Angronia Valley next to the Pelletier Valley where my family is from, they had a school of the Barbe. You go there and they have these little desks, you know, this goes back hundreds of years. You know, I started by saying the presence of this historical reality is very present. I mean, it's very present. They're very literate people. They have their own historians, their own theologians. It was very insular until, you know, 1848, when they finally granted civil rights to the Waldensians. Carlo Emanuel but that was after, as I said, centuries and centuries of sometimes vicious persecution, genocidal warfare, where they basically survived in the upper valleys and like. Anyway,
And they merged eventually with a lot of different groups. I know there's Waldensian Presbyterians and Methodists and some different groups. And there are still
There's the American Waldensian Society, and they have one church in New York.
Okay.
There's a big colony in North Carolina. I don't think they're, because they were basically admonished by the, you know, whatever, the Waldensian Synod, I guess, probably. I don't know exactly how it worked, to adapt to and to incorporate themselves into existing churches in the closest to their congregational thing, where, yeah, like the Presbyterians and I guess to some extent the Methodists, although that was somewhat controversial, I guess, at the time.
Oh, was that right?
Well, my great-grandfather became a Methodist minister. He kind of, because there's these theological debates at the time, and I never got that far into it, but he was failed at the school for like the whatever to become a Waldensian minister because he had a doctrinal difference, you know, in his oral exams. He refused to like say the right thing, apparently.
Yeah.
So he didn't become a Waldensian minister. So he became a Methodism was becoming this.
They're a little looser on the doctrine in that sense. Whereas I think the Waldensians in many respects were real Calvinists, or they connected a lot with John Calvin.
Well, I think that was one of their downfalls.
I don't disagree with you on that. Yeah, because that became very, very heady, very rigid. John Calvin's famously known for building a city so righteous nobody wanted to live in it. But my guest is Paul Rowland. He is the host of Wednesday Talk Radio on KBOO, and we're talking about the Waldensians, a movement. Heresy is in the eye of the beholder, in the eye of one with a lot of power, and the Waldensians were ruled as a heresy early on by the Roman Catholic Church in 12th century or early 13th century, but have existed for over 800 years as an independent group, as a group that's gone a great deal of persecution and marginalization. And I wonder, Paul. That's my question. How does that shape a people? And is there a sense in which that is part of their movement for justice in many different ways throughout history?
Oh, for sure. I mean, they're kind of, I think, considered, they feel like a real kinship, you know, I think with the, you know, with the Mennonites and with the Quakers, you know, the reason my dad immigrated to the United States was because he met some Mennonite workers. I'm not sure exactly who were there in Europe after the World War II as part of like Reconstruction efforts. There's this big agape ecumenical center that was built in the high, one of the high valleys there where the Waldensians are from. And that was as part of this sort of effort to heal the wounds of World War II. And, you know, of course, a lot of the Waldensians were involved in the resistance against fascism, too, which is another story. But anyway, so my dad met these Mennonites, and he ended up getting a scholarship to this Mennonite college, Bethel College in Kansas, which is how he ended up. And then he went to University of Kansas and met my mom, and the rest is history. But so, yeah, I mean, they have a very strong social justice kind of bent today. You know, they've been... a lot of them helped the Jews in World War II. A lot of them fought against fascism. There's some people now, more radical people now, I know, kind of said they didn't do quite enough at the time because they had become too institutionalized. You know, this, when you have that much history, it becomes extremely, extremely complex. But yeah, clearly they're, you know, in the American Waldensian Society, I think you go there, you probably see them active in a lot of the social justice causes that, you know, you think of typically as the Quakers and other groups like that being involved in. So yeah, I mean, you suffer oppression for that long. I mean, unless, you know, I guess thank goodness they didn't become their own state like Israel.
Huh. Well, that there's a negative side to that too, right, of constantly being oppressed, even when you are actually the oppressor. But right. I don't recognize any stories. I don't remember any of Waldensians being oppressors.
Well, I mean, then you talk to people now, though. It's like I say, there's sort of the radical faction of the valleys now, and some of them will say, "Oh, you know, the little Vatican," calling the Waldensian, you know, because they're, you know, they became essentially the sort of the, you know, the main institutional power in those valleys, you know? And so, yeah, you're going to get young people who react to that. So, yeah, I mean, we can't get into all that. I mean, how it affected me, I mean, like I say, my dad left the church.
So you didn't go necessarily to the church.
My parents were like nominally Unitarians. Uh-huh. I went to Unitarian Sunday school.
Okay.
So, you know, I mean, my mom was not religious. She was a rebel. They were both rebels. My dad was like heavily influenced by existentialism. So he basically like was that generation, the World War II generation that read Sartre and Camus and like, you know, but he maintained the sort of like, you know, social Christianity, you know, like he wrote essays about it and stuff in college.
So he did have a connection then from his Waldensian past. The social aspect of it.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah. For sure. He wrote essays about it. Uh-huh. He was editor. He founded this sort of kind of a literary magazine at University of Kansas. And so, and had like famous writers write and they wrote. And so that was part of what formed his outlook, existentialism. And so, you know, the social justice aspect of Christianity, for sure. I don't know. You know, I never got, he didn't really talk to us much, so I really never got that. But yeah, so what I got out of it was like first growing up, this family tree in our den, you know, TV room den with like Henri Arnault, this major figure in Waldensian, who's through a maternal line, through my going great, 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 great grandmother or something, married a son of this guy, Henri Arnault. So he wasn't, you know, in the paternal line. But anyway, he was like the major figure who kind of, you know, led the Waldensians back from exile in Switzerland in 1689. Anyway, he's this big figure of him with a sword in his hand, one hand, and a Bible in the other hand, which is like there's a big statue in the central, right next to the Waldensian church in Torrepellice, which is basically the center of the Waldensians, where they have their main institutions, and they have their synod, the political governing body of the Waldensian church, meets every summer. Anyway, so yeah, there's this figure, this Henri Arnault, at the top of this family tree, and like I only learned about it, you know, after, when it was basically too late to talk to my dad about it, because he had Parkinson's disease at that time. But anyway, I've read books about it and stuff. So it influenced me as this sort of legendary, mythical thing. And then I went back like twice as a kid to our farm, our family farm, which has remained in the family. In fact, I went to live there for 14 years. That's why I left KBOO left Portland for all that time. So yeah, it affected me in terms of this sort of like this semi lost in the midst of time, but like sort of heroic past to our family that kind of called me eventually to learn about it. And yeah, this guy Henri Arnault was a major figure, minor figure in European history, but major figure in Waldensian history, in that he was both their pastor and their military leader. You know, and he was very controversial because, you know, he basically like was like 100%er. You know, he was like no giving up, you know, compromise. Because, you know, basically they could have effected a compromise and probably saved a bunch of people. But they were like, he was like, there was this whole apocalyptic strain that kind of came into it, you know, through, you know, the whole idea of the Antichrist that became this big thing that, you know, now you look at fundamentalist Christianity, and to some extent it's the heir to that in a way, you know, it's like that, you know, it wasn't just Waldensianism. It was in the whole zeitgeist.
All of them. Yeah. Yeah. Even Luther, Martin Luther had, he didn't like necessarily images, but the only woodcut he has in his Bible translation is of the Roman church as the Antichrist, the Pope as the harlot of Babylon, and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, that definite idea of the apocalypticism was all the way through. Paul Rowland, I'm speaking with, he's the host of Wednesday Talk Radio on KBOO, an activist in Native American issues and for environmental issues. Let's go there for a little bit and talk about you and how you became involved in some of these things and what you've been doing on those fronts.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, like, whether there was a sort of a predisposition because of some of this history, which
but you're genetically Waldensian, and so there's...
Well, that's the thing. That's what I started to say. Let me answer that first. Let me say that, finish that first piece, which I never did at the very beginning. So I'm not Waldensian because I consider myself not Waldensian because I consider you to be Waldensian, you have to be a believer, you know, in certain theological tenets, you know. So I'm not really a Christian myself. I don't, you know, believe in, you know, necessarily even in the rebirth, whatever, the resurrection of Jesus, which I guess is a, you know, to be really Waldensian, you kind of have to believe that, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I believe that Jesus was a historical figure. I believe I'm closer to the Waldensian take on the life of Jesus, because they believed naked following a naked Christ. That was one of their big mottos. So basically, you know,
that's the voluntary poverty.
Yeah, the voluntary poverty and going against, you know, the big corrupt institutions.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was like, that's what got him in trouble. And that's, so I identify with them being rebels. How much that kind of consciously seeped in and informed my rebelliousness, I really have no way of knowing. But yeah, I became, you know, I came of adolescence during Watergate. So I was like obsessed following all that, you know, clipping out all these articles and just, you know, just absorbing it. I grew up in Washington, D.C. My dad ended up getting a job with the U.S. government, which is another story. United States Information Agency, which I should probably have to explain at some point. But anyway, so I grew up in the D.C. area, and, you know, with touched a little bit by the 60s because my older siblings to some extent, but it had kind of finished by the time I got to high school. But Watergate was going on. I went to like the last big like anti-Nixon demonstration with it must have been 100,000 people. That was in, what was it, like 74 before he resigned. So some of that seeped in, mm-hmm. you know, a little bit of the sort of this do-it-yourself culture that my dad kind of got steeped in. He worked for this magazine called Household Magazine, which is a do-it-yourself kind of thing in Topeka, Kansas. That was his first job, like major job like that. Anyway, so I got a little bit from the 60s. So anyway, I basically wasn't really involved politically until I came out west in 85 and fell in with the just through happenstance with some Native Americans who kind of this guy took me under his wing, kind of a renegade political activist, sort of medicine man type guy, Sundancer, peyote guy, who brought me up to Oregon in 85 and just opened up these whole worlds to me. I got involved in fishing, the fishing rights issue, got involved in Earth First. I was one of the first tree climbers, tree climber at Brighton Bush in November of 86. I just jumped into everything all at once and wrote for the Alliance newspaper, wrote all these articles about the forest protection movement, became very involved in the forest protection movement, wrote all these articles about the fishing rights movement, David So Happy and the salmon scam case, and got really tight with the Indian fishing community on the Columbia River, to some extent on the Yakima and Warm Springs reservations, the Portland community, helped start a group called the Sacred Earth Coalition, helped start a group called the Cascadia Forest Alliance, which had a brief but intense life in the late 90s, kind of after, you know, Earth First had kind of morphed into other things. So yeah, there's this whole intense stuff. And then, you know, I started to learn about this family history. And then my dad got sick and ended up not being able to had to retire. And I helped him travel to Italy for like every summer for about 7 years, which kind of was strange, kind of dual life that I led. And so kind of got to know firsthand, you know, that place in Italy where my family was from, and kind of, yeah, it had a major impression because I'd been so involved in indigenous issues. I got so, you know, I'd been invited to like sun dances, to other ceremonies. I got involved, you know, in Native American, you know, spiritual stuff without, you know, being like a formal adherent, but it had a huge influence on my life, you know, let's say direct revelation as opposed to scriptural revelation.
All right.
That's how sure. I differentiate myself from like Christianity. Because I had spiritual experiences, you know?
Personally, as opposed to here's what the book says. Yeah.
That was, yeah, huge. And so I talked about that actually at this Agape Center, a Waldensian in Oregon or something. I gave this talk to these young kids. It's still a major, vibrant ecumenical center there at Agape. Really, really interesting place. But anyway, so yeah, so then I had this whole other life in Italy, and basically, the point was that I saw myself so, I sort of started to get interested in my own, quote, indigenous roots. You know, that's a very fraught with difficulties phrase, you know, and I don't use it lightly, you know, but in a sense, you know, they were indigenous to northwestern Italy. You know, it's like, of course, you know, they had multiple ethnic, racial, whatever, you know, roots. But so I'm not Waldensian by religion, but I'm Waldensian by birth. And Waldensians, in some sense, have come to be known also as sort of a cultural group, you know, because they basically hold out as a people, you know, like Waldensians have certain last names, like mine is a Waldensian last name, you know, Arnaud, Arnoulé, Jahier, Gianavel, you know, or Gianavello. Then they became Italianized because Mussolini said they had to all have to end in a vowel.
So there's a sense in which there is a parallel between Jews and Waldensians in terms of religious and cultural identities.
There you go. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's obviously people picked up on that and that whole idea of Israel of the Alps, for sure. for sure. And it did become very insular, but then it started to open up, you know, as I said, with the, you know, there's these big periods, you know, there's periods of massacres, periods of repression, periods where they had to flee up into the upper valleys, periods where they couldn't, you know, they couldn't have a church below like, you know, 1500 meters or something like that. They had all these, you know, all these edicts by the feudal authorities, you know, that the Edict of Nantes was a relative tolerance that was revoked in 1685. That led to this another period of massacres where they were sent into exile. As I said, my ancestor Henri Arnault was their pastor and military leader who, you know, basically, like, as I said, was a maximalist. You know, he's like, no compromise. He was an apocalypticist. You know, it's like, we can't, compromise essentially with the horror of Babylon. And so there's other people probably, you know, maybe like, who knows, maybe even female leaders, you know, there's probably a whole, you know, alternative sure. history, you know, that like, you know, well, you know, maybe we shouldn't fight it out because we'll all be killed. There's reasons why indigenous leaders have affected, you know, have, you know, given in essentially because it's like, if you can't, you're not going to be able to beat them. But they ended up, you know, going into exile, like 6,000 people or something. And then they end up trying three times to come back across the Alps. Third time, they were successful. And they, through this miraculous, like, re-entry into the valley under the cover of this fog, they, like, against this, you know, amassed French army, they snuck into their valley, you know, under cover of fog. And these mythical stories is really amazing. It's an amazing history.
You know, and it's amazing in the sense too that you are culturally, genetically, we might say, Waldensian. But that's one thing. But it's another thing to go back and discover your history again and take from it those parts that are valuable that we want to use today. I mean, I think that's the goal of being able to be human today is to take our cultural past and redo it. And I think, frankly, the believers are overrated. Those people who talk about, you know, I get that all the time. I'm always a heretic in my tradition because I think beliefs are silly. But they're just beliefs. But you can take and draw from the large history of it and use those things for human flourishing in the present. And that's... those are the people I find interesting, and that's why you're interesting. Paul Rowland, my guest, a host of Wednesday Talk Radio, talking about the Waldensians and their history and their influence in the present. And one of the things they talk about is ecumenical work, interreligious dialogue. That's a big deal. And in a sense, that's what you were doing a little bit, intercultural, interreligious dialogue with your Native American contacts.
Yeah. No, I even like the reason I end up, like, one of the main reasons I ended up living there was because I first volunteered to help this campaign to protect Mount Graham, which is a Apache sacred site in Arizona, which had been a major multi-environmental group and Native Americans struggle for, you know, still kind of goes on. But the University of Arizona, along with the Arcetri Observatory of Florence, Italy, and the Vatican and Max Planck Institute were involved in this international observatory complex that they wanted to build initially with, like, they wanted to build 17 telescopes. Anyway, partly through our pressure, I was involved briefly, is it got reduced to three, but they did build the three telescopes. The Vatican has a observatory has a telescope up there, which is interesting twist on things. So obviously you can see how I got interested in this thing. So I was reading about this in the Earth First Journal for years, and I ended up going to the inauguration of the first two telescopes in 1993, the Vatican Observatory and the Max Planck Radio Observatory. And there's this incredible scene. It's like a typical Earth First scene at the time. You know, it was a really amazing heyday for the Earth First movement in the 80s and early 90s, where there's this like miles long backup of all these cars that were going to this inauguration because they had, like, two people had locked to this gate lower down. Then this friend of mine named Diana Valenzuela, now De Soto, who actually lives in Portland now, she's a part Apache. She was sitting on this tripod, three posts together on the very top of the mountains. Anyway, this whole multiple like action was blocking. So like there's Earth Firsters behind like Vatican Observatory, behind like, you know, like all mixed together in this long traffic. So anyway, I got up there and it was just it was an amazing action. I mean, it created a bit of a nightmare for them. It didn't stop the telescopes, you know, in these battles, we often are not able to like stop, like, you know, look at Standing Rock and the
And you were there at Standing Rock. Pipeline. You went out to North Dakota.
Yeah, I went out there too. But anyway, so I was like very impressed. You know, it was one of the most sophisticated and like comprehensive battles in environmental and native. And it was where at the time it was at a time where Native American and environmental struggles were crossing paths, due, I would say, mainly to Earth First, somewhat to Greenpeace, give them some credit. But Earth First was like the main group that was forging on the ground alliances, doing direct action and getting to know Native people, you know, so they were working with the Apaches, the San Carlos Apaches, to some extent the White Mountain, and then through them, national Native organizations. This is a, you know, built up over a long campaign. And I actually, so I basically volunteered to go to Italy because we had a guy there for like a year, you know, trying to, you know, organize in Italy against both the Vatican and Arcetri Observatory of Florence. So that got me to Italy for like a year. Right. I had only spent, you know, like weeks there before, you know, several times, you know, so I was there in 93, 94. And that kind of got sort of this bug in me, you know, just Italian culture and like knowing my own. So, you know, and then because I had gone there every summer with my parents, that kind of started the whole thing. And then going there to work on this Mount Graham campaign, I got to know people more. I got to know Italian better. So then I kind of reached this crisis point, basically. This is kind of the story of my life, is around like 96. I had been leading this double life, going every summer to Italy. And then I spent a whole year there. Anyway, it was like, it ended up being like more than I could handle. It's like, it was, I don't know what I was thinking, really. Is take a long time to explain, but I was trying to do this. And then I got involved in like the whole Columbus centenary stuff around 1992. I helped organize an Apache to go to Geneva, where there's a big, huge exhibit in October, you know, leading up to October of 92. So I helped organize through the Greens, the Verdi, the Greens in Turin, Italy, and some solidarity, human rights solidarity groups and Native American solidarity groups. Helped organize the first like organizing thing I did was back in 92. This Apache guy to go to Geneva. So I got this whole, like, because the whole quincentenary thing was going on, the 500th anniversary. And so, like, Italy, you know, Columbus being Italian, I just got thrust myself into this huge, like, vast, like, historical, like, reflection. It was a major thing, 92, like, major indigenous organizing, major transcontinental conferences right. going on, you know, major, like, Europeans looking back, you know, like it sort of educated a whole new generation of activists about like getting back to, you know, like history. And then the next year, you know, 93 was the 150th anniversary of the Oregon Trail. And we had our own stuff. And I was like involved in, you know, these protests that were, you know, protesting logging on an area where a spur of the Barlow Road was going through. Is like, you know, kind of mind-boggling looking back on it, how you said, you know, like using the past, but for me it's like also a window in our lives, our families are our windows into the past. To my life happens to, I think, afford these really incredibly, you know, unique windows, you know, maybe more than a lot of other people, partly because I have, you know, known family history, but partly because, you know, who's Waldensian and is able to like learn about all this and then gets involved with Native American stuff and then gets involved with, as I said, with this Vatican telescope. So I was there like organizing against this, getting to know like, you know, Native American support groups, environmental groups, human rights groups, trying to do this big coalition similar to the coalition that was happening in the United States between environmental groups, human rights groups, you know, Amnesty International, like all these, they formed this incredible coalition, remarkable, called the Mount Graham Coalition, you know, really unique, you know, in its time. And so I was part of that. So that's what got me to Italy, like, for a longer period. And yeah, that just kind of caught the bug. So I was had this crisis basically around 96 where, like, I couldn't keep going back and forth and back and forth in it because it was basically taking a serious psychic toll on me. So for some reason, I opted to go to Italy, which I could probably get way more deeper into that than I'm probably willing to go. But so, yeah, so I ended up moving to this farm in Italy, this chestnut farm, which before you ask me another question, I'll just basically say, so another big thing that really attracts me about the Waldensian is basically they were basically like small farmers. They're basically like a sustainable culture. I mean, they basically like had it good, you know, it's like, and they knew it. It's like, they were against the feudal system. They didn't want to be part of all that. They just like so many resistance, they were like,
they went off the medieval grid.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And that got them into all sorts of trouble, you know, and they basically, you know, I mean, this is probably romanticizing a little bit, you know, there's probably all sorts of stuff to criticize about, but you know, they also were relatively egalitarian, you know, women could be lay preachers as well. I mean, that was a big right. part of their culture, you know, it's like, I'm sure they had some of the same contradictions, but yeah, there's a lot, you know, there's lots attractive, but that was like, you know, I went back to basically like take care of my own family's chestnut farm. So, you know, the idea was that they basically, the Waldensians survived. I went to this lecture once by Giorgio Turin, he's probably no longer with us, but the great, you know, Waldensian historian who's written numerous books, you know, this, I forget what the talk was like, I think it was about like chestnuts and Waldensians, or something crazy anyway, or just a part of his talk was basically saying that they basically survived on chestnuts and milk because during the vicious persecution times, they basically, you know, retreated up in the upper valleys. And so, chestnuts and milk happened to be a very complete combination in terms of various food elements. So, you know, obviously they had other things, but they really did survive on chestnuts and their animals.
Sure.
You know, that's the small farm system that I adopted, you know, that I took over in midstream, basically from the tenant farmers that had been living there for 50 years almost, right? It's basically like I didn't have the animals, but it's basically like you have chestnut trees and then pasture underneath the chestnut tree. So you graze your animals under the chestnuts. They fertilize the chestnuts. You use the leaves instead of straw for the under the animals during the winter, right? You put that back on the fields and your garden. And, you know, you harvest the chestnuts. You trade some of the chestnuts for corn to the plains down below, you know, when you could. Very rich, you know, and then you had a few fruit trees, you had potatoes, you know, it's like basically my family became a prominent, you know, fairly wealthy family. They were one of the first probably bourgeois Waldensian families. And that's a history that we don't know completely when they stopped being farmers, but they had been farmers. Obviously, like they were all small farmers. So that's what attracted me is basically it was an old permaculture system that really worked, you know? I mean, you know, and the whole issue of animals and stuff is like a whole separate question. But anyway, I think it was very appropriate because these mountain pasture land is very, very rich. I mean, then you get into like all the like younger generations now that are like more like kind of like me, you know, who are like, you know, into anti-authoritarianism, so there's a whole small back to land movement, people, because now they're abandoning, through industrialization, they're abandoning all the high Alps and stuff. So anyway, there's this incredibly rich history that I threw myself into, you know, and then I tried to organize with the Waldensians to help stop the Mount Grand Telescope. I didn't succeed very well. And you know, the whole issue to revoke the Inter-Saterra Bull, which basically laid the groundwork for federal Indian law, you know, the idea that basically the first Christian nation to discover, you know, land has the right to conquer that, you know. So I had an article printed in the Waldensian newspaper about that, you know, stuff like that. I mean, I consider what I did there a little overly ambitious, and I think I ultimately failed in my grandest plans to like bring this whole all these cycles together. But yeah, so that's like in a chestnut shell, sort of a little snapshot of what I was doing there.
Thank you for that. Paul Rowland has been talking with me about thinking as you're talking how people get their inspiration, how they get their where they find their soul or their spirit to take on the things that matter. And part of that is finding our refining our history and finding those elements in it. And the Waldensian history in this part, you know, all the so-called heretical movements, one could look at them as simply disputes over authority. Who has the authority to do this to you? And the Waldensians were the first to claim authority for themselves. You even mentioned yourself,
well,
kind
not
of
the first,
not on
I mean,
for themselves, but for
they actually
not
say,
selfish way. But I mean,
yeah.
It isn't going to be some hierarchy
right.
That's going to tell people what to do. There's an authority connected with perhaps in their sense the divine of some sort or another, and you can have more direct access
well, the Bible,
to that.
The Bible is the ultimate authority, and then you can get into the whole. You know, we could probably agree on a lot of reasons why that is very criticizable. But, you know, they did apparently, you know, they even say that there are people called the Waldenses or Vaudois even before Peter Waldo. So, you know, they were part of this, you know, long chain of heretical movements, you know, resistance movements going back to the early years and centuries of Christianity. But they were unique in that they survived again as an institution, but they are also somewhat unique in going back to your point about inspiring the Protestant Reform, helping inspire the Protestant Reformation, because apparently he either commissioned or helped did the translation work himself of the first apparently translation of the New Testament into the what they call Arpaton. It's the Franco-Provençal, the what's now in the Aosta Valley, the main language.
Vulgar language, certainly
yeah,
the common language.
Yeah, the common language, not Latin,
right.
Because they
language
had control,
people.
Because people couldn't even read what Christ said, because it was very selectively interpreted. You know, it's like you'd say, the priest would be able to say this and that during the sermon, but people couldn't actually read what Christ supposedly actually said. I mean, there's so many layers to this, but I think obviously that was a major thing that opened up, you know, because that was it was copied at that time because, you know, the Gutenberg, you know, hadn't been, the printing press hadn't even been invented.
Yeah, three centuries before
right.
the printing press by
right.
now.
So, you know, they copied the first large-scale copying of the Bible into the Vulgate so people could actually read it, which itself then helped spur greater. So then people could take clandestine copies around as they were, you know, because they became sort of missionaries, you know, the Waldensians. They go two by two, you know, kind of like who are the ones now that go door to door?
Yeah, you know, our Mormon friends, they go door to door, our elders. Yeah, two by two. That's a long tradition that goes back to the New Testament of going out there and doing your thing. You know, there's something that's running through my mind throughout all this, and you talked about it when you were at the Mount Graham resistance, and you talk about how it necessarily didn't stop, you know, the bad people from doing their thing, the empire from doing its thing. And yet at the same time, that's the case. So what keeps us going? What keeps us going against these so-called losing causes, perhaps? And part of that is the history of people who survive in the midst of that. 800 years with the Waldensians, for example. I mean, there's something about that that is also inspirational to keep the good fight going.
Yeah, I was just in Warm Springs Reservation yesterday for this root feast, the traditional root feast yesterday, which was just a beautiful, beautiful ceremony, I gotta say. Anyway, and just the perseverance. And, look what happened at Standing Rock. I mean, they inspired themselves, first of all, and then they inspired other people. I mean, it's we have to inspire each other. You know, it's like one person stands up. That's why the empire, the authority figures have to continually knock down every resistance movement that comes away, because you know, they know that it can inspire examples. So they have to, it's a gruesome reality that's, I think, the nature of the viciousness of the repression, you know, is that they know, in their heart of hearts, they know they're wrong, first of all. And so they have a bad conscience.
Yeah.
And so they can only keep it going by brute force. And they can't afford to let these examples get to, you know, well, we're, you know, the death of Martin Luther King Jr. we're commemorating right now, or the speech, first of all, and then his assassination. What a perfect example of someone who, and again, you know, he harks back to the Protestant tradition, which harks back to the Waldensians too.
That's right. Yeah, and like with King's speech, I mean, everybody said it was the wrong thing, but he was right. He was right then, and he's right now. And because it's there, it's their record, we can still draw on it for our resistance movements today. Paul Rowland, my guest, talking about the Waldensians, past and present, and their legacy, and as a group. I'm inspired by hearing you talk about them and reintroducing me to one of the groups that had been kind of a footnote there in my seminary training, and now I realize they're a really central group in terms of resistance in many ways.
Well, geopolitically also. I mean, they were like that whole crisis they became sort of a flashpoint for the whole Protestant thing, you know, like the fact that they were supported by Oliver Cromwell, you know, and that's an interesting thing. You know, that's a thing that I think they need to get over themselves too. They need to look at the Waldensians, look at, you know, their support for the Puritans, you know, this. I think they're sort of blinders, probably to some extent, for their ability to look at American history with correct eyes too, because I don't think they, you know, this whole idea, you know, but they should be their own best example, you know. It's like, sure, Waldensians did emigrate, you know, because mostly for the both religious and economic reasons. But, you know, it's like they also stayed, you know, they didn't become themselves necessarily. There probably were Waldensians early on. There's certainly Huguenots early on, you know, and the Huguenots and the Waldensians were, you know, basically part of the same. The Huguenots was just a generic term for French Protestants. So the people who had, you know, either, you know, had to go underground or whatever, you know, after the massacres, the Easter massacre in what was it, 1655, I think, of French Protestants, including Waldensians, that bit which basically drove the Waldensians as a formal thing out of France. But anyway, so I guess the point is, you know, the Puritans screwed up royally, you know. I mean, they became, you know, their ideological illusions, their cultural blinders and ideological illusions blinded them, you know, to the reality that, like, indigenous people actually were, like, A, human beings, B, you know, had their own rich cultural, spiritual traditions that were equally and perhaps more valid than the Puritans' own, you know. You know, it's like this whole sordid history of the linking of Christianity and empire is
one indeed, yeah, and a violent one, and it continues today. And the lesson I get here learning is that even as we look back into our history and find those of nuggets of resistance and things that we can use, we also recognize that it's always a clouded history, and it's always and we have to read it critically and draw from what we can and criticize that what we can't. And that's one thing, to get on another topic of mine, is that the United States of America is not self-critical in that regard. In fact, it praises continual loss of memory and a reinvention of memory in a certain way. And if there's an element of resistance to that, certainly finding the truth of our of and owning up to our dark histories.
Well, I think that fuels the Trumpism and this, yeah. You know, the you know, the the quote right wing Christianity, the whole complex of, you know, prosperity religion, you know, bootstrap ideology, the manifest destiny,
white superiority, you know, and all that stuff.
White supremacy, the whole thing. It, you know, like I've had it within my own family. You know, it's like I've had debates about, like, you know, this history. I won't go into all that, but I think it's the challenge, you know, whether it's the quincentennial challenge to the, you know, the Columbus myth and ideology, you know, whether it's Native Americans standing up against this whole ideology of manifest destiny and of the Christian, you know, the Christian supremacy as the basis for, you know, in some ways for the Constitution itself, certainly for federal Indian law. I think it's people, again, it's like they know they're not right. They know this whole thing is built on false foundations, and so they have to redouble their efforts. And I think that's the kind of the hidden history of this whole thing. It's not just a positive assertion of power. It's like, it's basically a redoubling of, you know, because they have no foot to stand on initially, they have to continue, redouble the manipulation and repression to not allow that reality truth to come forward.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
like the whole reaction to the 60s, and, you know, the 60s was this whole, you know, the whole revisionist, quote, revisionist history, you know, that, you know, what's his name, the People's History, Howard Zinn, and other people kind of help usher in, which is not just them, it's this whole generation of scholars that actually, you know, look at the other side of the history. They actually, you know, go into records deeper and actually look at, you know, what was the history of the treaties. What are the, you know, what was the Native American actual experience? What was the African American experience? You know, what did the records actually say? And it's like, you really look at that and you see that, you know, that actually it wasn't as the history books actually said. And that sort of, those cracks in the edifice, you know, that's, you know, the whole Koch brothers and et al, you know, reaction through the Heritage Foundation stuff, that's a big theme that I've been exploring in my talk radio show, is that's like our, you know, the past 50 years of history is almost this, you know, like some people called it the third or fourth or something Great Awakening, you know, the 60s, you know, about the Great Awakenings,
mm-hmm,
obviously.
Sure.
Yeah, so in fact, my mom's ancestors were part of the Great Awakening. Like, one was a Christian church, you know, minister who met at this great meeting in Kentucky in 1800 or something, you know. So, like, my mom's done her own. So there's this whole other side on my mom's side, which I should probably give equal voice to. But now we've talked for probably who knows how long, I won't be able to. But anyway, so yeah, that whole like going against that, the you know, the victor writing the history, I think it disturbs the conscience. It also disturbs their interest too, because if they have to question where the banks got their initial capital, you know, whether it's the Bank of Britain or whatever, you know, from slavery, you know, all the, if you look, you know, now there's all these, you look at all the major banks, they all go back to, like, the slave trade, you know.
Oh yeah.
Or, you know, usurpation of, or, you know, like, look at Wells Fargo and the gold rush and the genocide of the California Indians. You know, it's like, it's all, yeah, it's like this whole empire system can't question itself. It can't have self-reflection, because if it did have true self-reflection, it would have to change. And obviously it's incapable of change. And I think it's going to kill us all personally, but
Well, it very well could. But thankfully, we've got those with Waldensian heritage and others at least to tell us when the empire doesn't have any clothes on. Paul Rowland has been my guest. Wednesday Talk Radio. Check that out. 8 to 9 every Wednesday on KBOO 90.7. Paul Rowland with me to talk about the Waldensians past and present. Paul, thank you for being with me.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to The Beloved Community every second Friday at 9 a.m. on 90.7 KBOO. I'm John Shuck. Be well.